Accession number 26731, Reel 3.
Leonard Vincent Knowles, Reel 3. You were talking about the different types of aircraft that the company had.
We had Lancasters, which was the wartime bomber, and the Lancastrian, which was a development of the wartime bomber. It was built for civilian use. We had about, I suppose, 50% of each. And these were used to transport diesel oil and petrol to Berlin. Where the Bombay used to exist, they built a petrol tank there. Flying to Berlin, they used to fill that with, as I say, either diesel oil or petrol. Each Lancaster had three tanks in each wing. The inner tanks of each wing also were filled with diesel oil. So the aircraft would fly to Berlin and back on the petrol in the two outer tanks. The average load was about 2,000 gallons. From at that time, we had at Wunsdorf, we had a gang of Germans and displaced personnel who were used to de-ice the aircraft, because this is February, March, and it was very, very cold out there, but it's cold as I've ever been, I think, working on that airfield. And they were engaged with the lorry with these tanks of de-icing fluid on the back, and they would go around, as I say, de-icing. But unfortunately, they discovered that the de-icing fluid had an alcohol base, and quite a few of them used to be seen consuming this stuff. Sorry. Well, that was Wunsdorf. In April, at Easter time, we were told we were being transferred to Hamburg, or Fussbüttel Airport. So the whole operation was moved there, and we were then billeted in hotels in the centre of Hamburg, what was left of it. From there, the pattern of the flights was more obvious, inasmuch as aircraft would leave Fussbüttel Airport at 6:45. So 6:45 in the morning, there would be two or three flight refueling aircraft. And from the other side of the hard standing at Fussbüttel, you had Bond Air Services and Eagle Airways, and they were running Holtons, which was a development of the Halifax, and they were usually loaded with coal or flour and so forth. So from 6:45 in the morning, you would have two or three of our Lancasters and two or three of their Holtons taken off. They weren't allowed to fly at any other time, only to the odd hour. At 6:15 the odd hour, you would get aircraft returning that had taken off at 5:15 in the morning. So from 7:15 until 9:15, we had an hour and a half to service that aircraft and to reload it and do whatever was necessary. So for the next, after they took off at 9:15, we had until 9:15 to grab a meal. And that's how the cycle went on throughout the whole day. It was a 4-hour cycle. So within 24 hours, any one aircraft could make 6 return flights to Berlin. So if you had 2,000 gallons per flight, you're talking about 12,000 gallons of petrol or diesel oil.
From your point of view, did it mean you had to check the radio each time?
Well, you didn't have to check it unless it was reported unserviceable. Again, we had the same sort of setup, but it was a bit better organised. We had a proper workshop there. And it wasn't such a helter-skelter sort of thing as it was down at Wunsdorf. And it was warmer. The spring had arrived. The weather was much more pleasant. It was still the same 12-hour shifts. And we had our own engineers plain fare, as they called it, mess, specially built, as was our workshop, specially built for the occasion. There was a bit of indiscipline with some of the air crew.
The civilian air crew?
Flight Refueling's air crew. They had to recruit, expand their air crew quite a lot. They had over 200 air crew altogether, I think. And they were recruiting people who could see that this wasn't going to last very long, and they were ex-RAF air crew with the same sort of, shall we say, devil-may-care attitude. And they knew that the airlift wouldn't last long, and they were going to enjoy themselves. Well, the management of Flight Refueling took exception to this, and they were threatening to pull out of the airlift at that time. And they sent out Wing Commander Johnson, who was the big chief, to install a bit of discipline to it all.
So was each civilian contractor responsible, entirely responsible?
Yes.
Excuse me. So was each civilian contractor entirely responsible,
yes,
for their aircraft,
mm-hmm,
and their crew?
Yes, right.
So Flight Refueling Limited would have their own engineers,
pilots, fitters, everything.
Everything.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
A whole team,
yes,
of maintenance,
mm-hmm,
crew,
yes,
ground crew,
mm-hmm,
and,
yes,
and their own pilots.
Yes.
How did you fit into, or what contact did you have with the RAF?
Nothing up there.
Was it a purely civilian operation up there?
There's all the civilian aircraft, well, not all, but the only aircraft flying out of there at that time were civilian. It was a civilian airport. All the other airfields used in Western Germany were ex-Luftwaffe airfields, but this was primarily civilian, as it is today. I mentioned Bond Air Services flying Holton aircraft. Well, the owner at that time of Bond Air Services was Freddie Laker, Sir Freddie Laker. He ran that cheap airline, I think it was called now. He was running cheap air flights to the States for quite a while until he was put out of business by British Airways, really. But another airline there was the Eagle Airways, which I think was a subsidiary of the Cunard. But we had very little contact with them at all. As I say, they were the other side of the tarmac. At the same time, foosbottle was being used by civilian airlines, flying it, say, Scandinavian Airlines, various other airlines.
What did you do when you weren't working?
Well, there was the nightlife in Hamburg consisted mainly of the quite near our hotel, there was this Bavarian type beer hall with the Umpa band and all the rest of it. We used to get in there quite a bit.
And how were you treated by the German civilians?
It's strange, really, because you talked to quite a few of them, and you got the feeling that the only thing Hitler ever did wrong was lose the war. And two or three of them came out with the same story about how Allied bomber crews parachuted into Germany after being shot down, how the civilian population used to rough them up, but this particular person I was talking to tried to persuade them not to. And you got the same story from several people, so it was all a bit suspect, really. But there was no aggravation at all.
But there was no positive, you didn't feel there was any positive support? Because after all, the purpose of the airlift was to keep the civilian population.
Oh, yes. They weren't anti at all, no. There was just waitresses at the plane fare restaurant at Foosbottle, the bar staff in the hotel. The hotel was run by the Control Commission for Germany. It was a British manager and manageress managing this hotel. This particular hotel is all grain crew. The air crew were accommodated in other better class hotels in Hamburg.
Is there anything else you remember about that time?
Only that working conditions, we were given, I think it was 3 shillings a day subsistence allowance, which we didn't really need because all the meals were provided, all the transport was provided. I also drew a little of the money. I think we were on £8 a week. Every 4 weeks, we were entitled to a week at home. They would fly us home at their expense and pay us for the full week. I think I had about 3 of those altogether. But one of them I used to go to Copenhagen. I flew up there with Scandinavian Airlines and spent a week in Copenhagen. But, of course, the airlift, the blockade proper, ended in May. But the airlift continued until early October, I think it was. But in the meanwhile, the whole thing was being scaled down. And every week that went by, they used to pay off one or the other of us. But it was during this period we made the most flights, I think. In June, we made, I think it was 800 trips to Berlin. This chap Johnson, who came out to wave the big stick at us, put out a notice saying that if at any one time any flights to Berlin was missed due to anyone's error, he would be discharged. Never happened, but it put us on our toes a bit. This particular record of 800 flights in June, against that, they used to publish all these charts in the office, flights missed and so forth, and against that we had 6 flights cancelled because of radio faults. But we were a bit cunning with that, because if the 2 or 3 aircraft came in back from Berlin and 2 of them reported radio faults and a couple of them reported engine faults, then usually the engine fault would take longer to cure. So the aircraft with the engine fault and the radio fault, we left the fitters to take responsible for cancelling that flight. And we used our own time to correct the radio fault, so that didn't count against us. So, although, as I say, we only had 6 against us, and it wasn't really as good as that. But that competitive edge came in at that time. I think it was about must have been in August. They sent me back, paid me off.
Was there a competitive edge with other companies as well?
I don't think so, no.
Or just within your company?
But just within the grain crews, that was all. I think at the end, the Air Ministry said that they were, and they were scaling down, and they were offering contracts to these particular, to the various civilian airlines. And Flight Refueling said, well, if it's only going to be whatever it was, 12 flights a day, they wanted a lot. Anything less than that was no use to them. As I say, I came back about end of July, early August, and they still went on for a few more weeks after that. But I was speaking to the archive, Flight Refueling archive chap, and he said to me that this was 4 or 5 years ago, that Flight Refueling came out of it very badly in the end, financially. They committed so many aircrew on, not long contracts, but contracts that overran the length of the airlift, so they were no better off financially, apart from all that work they put in, that we put in.
Coming from having worked as a wireless fitter in the RAF, to going straight to working for a civilian firm in a similar capacity, what were the differences? Were there any?
Well, as I say, I had the problem with getting a skilled ticket with the Electrical Trades Union, would have him work those 6 months as a skilled tradesman. And as I said, it overshot my 21st birthday. Then I was able to get my full ticket. Well, I was able to work for 2 months when I came back. But during that time, flight refueling kept sending me money, holiday entitlements, redundancy money, and something else. It was unending, really. So I was very well taken care of. But the first job I had was in the docks. Everything in South Down from that time went towards the docks. I was working for British Railways Marine Section.
As an electrician?
As an electrician on the cross-channel ships. They used to come, at that time, they all used to come up from Dover to be serviced and converted. That lasted until the following June, and then I was laid off from there. Then I got a job at Farnborough as a wireless fitter in the guided weapons division at Farnborough. But that wasn't very satisfactory. Living away from home again, you were in more or less barrack accommodation, but without the spirit that existed in the Air Force. You miss that sort of thing. So it was back to Southampton Docks.
As an electrician?
As an electrician. Working for British Railways, for Thornycroft, for Highland and Wolf. I worked on all the liners at that time, Queen Mary, Queen Elizabeth, Mauritania, all the Union Castle liners, Royal Mail liners. But that was casual. They could say, put one word at a place and you'd be out. It was as drastic as that, really. And there was no prospects at all. There was no pension scheme. All in all, I had 17 changes of employment. I was working one time at some wiring chicken houses all over Hampshire and the south of England. And to Northern Ireland, I went once. Then, about 40, 64, I was employed by Pirelli's and stayed there for 28 years, which was the saviour, really, because they had a pension scheme. And today we're quite comfortable.
What is the most outstanding memory that you have of your time when you were involved in the Berlin Airlift?
The whole thing, really. I mean, other people went through... I didn't go through the war as a serviceman. Other people can talk about some Arnhem, Dunkirk, Alamein and whatever, but that, in a very minor role, was my war effort, if you like, because it was virtually... It could have led to World War III. I didn't know at the time when I took the job on that quite how drastic it was, because apparently the Americans had shifted two squadrons of atom bombers to Britain, just in case things got out of hand.
I wanted to ask you, how much were you aware of at the time of the significance of what you were doing and the importance of keeping West Berlin going?
Well, it was really a continuation of the war. We've been through 6 years of war. There was a certain amount of menace attached to that all the time. There was the RAF service and the service in Aden, which was a bit edgy at times, and it was just a continuation of that. There's no great peak of feelings against it.
I mean, were you aware of what you were doing at all?
Oh, yes, oh, yes.
I mean, did you ever have any visits from any politicians or...
No, no.
Any people like that?
No.
Is there anyone you remember particularly from your time working in Germany?
Well, there were one or two characters that I haven't been in contact with since. There's one fellow who was involved with the... Hyderabad business in India. When India was given independence, Hyderabad had some sort of private war going on. And there was a sort of mercenary airlift going on, supplying Hyderabad with arms at that time. And this fellow was worked on those aircraft as an engine mechanic. And there's another fellow who was the widest fitter, and he'd been involved in some sort of smuggling operation with the RAF from Germany to the UK. And he had been taken to court, he feigned guilty. He was sentenced to jail, but he had the option of paying this fine. It was quite a heavy fine. And he had to borrow money to pay the fine rather than go to jail. Well, he was there working with us, and he was still clad in his RAF uniform, which he'd cut down and civilianized up to a point, the shirts, the greatcoat, everything. Well, a good 18 months to 2 years after, my friend and I were in the centre of London. We often used to meet out there, and we bumped into him. And he's still wearing the same suit, the same greatcoat. And in the meanwhile, he'd been working in Egypt on King Farouk's yacht. And so quite a lot of the air crew had been involved with the Hyderabad business. Of course, it's not remembered much today, but it took the headlines at the time in 46, 47.
So they're a bit dodgy,
was it? Well, yes, a bit like that. There's very hard drinkers there. Very hard drinkers.
But they were all ex-RAF, were they?
Ex-RAF, Fleet Air Arm. One or two of them might well have been Army, Royal Mechanical Engineers, I suppose. Yes, that's about it.
Thank you very much.